I'll call the meeting to order. This is the Finance Committee. It's 1:32 on Wednesday, January 29th. Members present are Representative Holmes, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Guerra, Representative Costello, Representative Osterman, Representative Wilson, Representative Edgman, Representative Newman. Today we are going to continue our department overviews with the, and we'll start with the Department of Labor. And following the Department of Labor, we'll have Mental Health Authority before us. So Commissioner Bloom, and you'll bring your staff up and introduce yourself, and we'll go ahead and get started.
Good afternoon, Representative Osterman and committees of the Finance Committee. Today, I am going to do an overview of the Department of Labor for you. I'm going to do it relatively quickly because most of you have seen this before. And then we'll have a little more time if you have specific questions and things we can get back to you on that are of specific interest to you. I want to introduce members of the Department of Labor family, Assistant Commissioner Gray Mitchell. And he's also the director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division, and our Administrative Services Director, Paloma Harbor. So with that, I will...
For our members, you will hold questions till the commissioner is done before we get into them.
Okay, thank you. I will be quick and brief going through the overview unless you have specific questions, because I don't want to provide duplicate information that we provided last year in the interest of time. So as most of you will remember, we have three core services. It's to protect Alaskan workers, income replacement, and the workforce development component in our department. And with the projects on the horizon and some of the things that are happening, the workforce development component is one of the largest components in our department. And you will see that through some of Paloma's demonstrations and some of her pie charts a little later. How that shapes up with the other divisions in our department, not to diminish the protection of Alaskan workers or the income replacement components, though. Here's an organizational chart. It's not laid out as the standard organizational chart, but laid out more for a functional organizational chart. So you'll notice that the dark blue areas primarily provide departmental oversight, such as the Commissioner's Office and the Administrative Services Division. The light blue colored areas provide workforce development functions, which I'll briefly describe. I won't go into detail, but if you would like more, please let us know. The business partnerships component is our division. It's our arm that reaches out to business and industry to assist them in design, policy, and implementation of training and workforce development programs. The Employment Security Division has two components within the core services, so you'll hear me mention this division twice, which is why this org chart is a little bit different. In the workers' comp development component, this group operates as a public labor exchange, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with that, but we can get into more detail if you'd like. The Alaska Workforce Investment Board, which is here meeting in Juneau today and tomorrow, and I encourage any of you who have a few minutes tonight, the reception is at the hangar, 5:30 to 7. Go down and talk with our business and industry leaders to hear about what kind of workforce development ideas and challenges that they have before that board. The Alaska Vocational Technical Center, AVTEC, is our adult vocational training school in Seward. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. And the Vocational Rehabilitation Division has two components. In the workforce development element, the staffs assist individuals with disabilities to obtain and maintain employment. The brown colored boxes identify the Labor Standards and Safety Division, which provides enforcement, training, and monitoring of the laws governing occupational safety and health, and many others. The Alaska Labor Relations Agency, you're all familiar with that component. The green colored area provides income replacement for those not able to work. Are looking for work. So that would include the Workers' Compensation Division, Disability Determination, and the Employment Security Division. Slide 4 basically shows you where we provide services throughout the state. And we have 21 job service centers throughout the state currently. That is one of the areas that will be a challenge for us in the coming years. The red areas define where we have a job service center currently. The blue areas are our vocational rehabilitation staffed offices. And then AvTech is the purple, which you can hardly see, and there's a institution in Seward and in Anchorage. You will not see on this chart all of the other partners and grantees that we work with. We are currently working on a more interactive website so that you would see that we would be able to show you where some of the training dollars are, what regions they're in, and what those training opportunities are in each region. And we hope to have that by the end of this FY put together and an interactive component. Our mission's broad, and we certainly don't do it alone. We have many, many partnerships, state and private. In the interest of time, I won't go through each of these partnerships listed here, but I'll be happy to provide more information on any of these. I will highlight just a few, and I've heard a couple other I've heard Commissioner Schmidt up here talking a little bit about recidivism, and it seems to be an area that folks are focusing on, and the Department of Labor is certainly focusing on that. We're very proud of some of the work that we've done, and we've had some staff that have been diligent in working with reducing recidivism. One of the ones I would like to highlight is our non-traditional trades for incarcerated women. We granted some funding to the Highland Mountain Correctional Facility, and it trains the women in courses on blueprint and design, carpentry and plumbing, advanced carpentry and plumbing, alternative energy, mining and safety and health. And we do have some unvetted numbers here today, so I don't want to throw those numbers out. I'd like to vet them first with the Department of Corrections. But the numbers that were presented to us from the Job Service Centers show that in 2012, the recidivism rate of the people who completed the course was 50% less, and even better in 2013. And like I said, I would like to share those numbers with you as soon as we actually vet them, because I don't want to provide information that later we have to retract. So from what we can see, and from what our folks on the ground can see, it is working. It's a program that is very, very beneficial. And for anybody who's more interested in that, it was called Bridge to Success through our Eagle River Center, and it's been a phenomenal program. Our Construction Education Foundation is also a big one. They are working closely with some of the school districts to provide dual credits for some of the students that attend and complete that course. So here's a few more of our training and education private partners, and like I said, we'll get information on any of those that you would like to hear about in more detail. So you will see, I'm going to turn it over to Paloma, who's our Admin Services Director. You will see that we have been diligent in tightening our budget. We've taken this self-assessment that we imposed on ourselves last year to look for duplicacies, to look for efficiencies, and to look for better public service. We've taken that serious. You will see that our budget is down substantially. We've done that without any major program cuts at this point. I don't know that we'll be able to maintain every single program if this budget decline continues. We are dealing with challenges that we are primarily federally funded, so declining federal funds and increased operating expenses are a challenge for us, as well as many of our other departments. So with that, I'll turn it over to Paloma and let her walk you through the financial components. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Osterman and committee. For the record, my name is Paloma Harbor. I'm the Administrative Services Division Director for the department. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about the department's FY 2015 budget in the context of our prior year performance by core service, a look back at the department's budget since FY 2006, and a look forward to the department's 10-year plan. I'd be happy to go into any further detail on these topics. Again, as the commissioner mentioned, in the future if you have specific questions we're not able to address today. As the commissioner mentioned, one of the department's core services is to promote safe and legal working conditions for Alaskans. The department does this through a combination of enforcement and consultative efforts to both employers and employees. One measure that the department uses to track performance in this area is the workplace lost time injury and illness rate per 100 employees. In FY 2013, this rate declined to 1.61 from 1.73 the previous year. This is the second lowest level ever achieved, or at least in the past 12 years, and I think ever. The lowest level was 1.60, so very close to where we're at now. As can be seen on this slide, significant strides have been made in this area over this time frame. The department also provides income replacement to injured, unemployed, and disabled Alaskans. For the Alaskans in these situations, timely benefit payments are extremely important for providing some semblance of stability. Therefore, the department focuses on timeliness measures when looking at this performance. In federal fiscal year 2013, the department processed 91.7% of unemployment insurance payments within 21 days, exceeding the federal benchmark of 87% and the prior year performance of 91.5%. This was while experiencing an 11% increase in the total number of claimants served from just over 56,000 to 62,500. Last but not least, the department advances opportunities for employment for Alaskans in Alaska. The total number of resident workers in Alaska in 2011 was 331,081, up 2,470 from the prior year. 2012 resident worker information will be available after Friday. This chart speaks to the health of Alaska's economy. Jobs are continuing to grow. The department is also presenting on the next slide a performance measure for the Vocational Rehabilitation Program that provides employment services for disabled Alaskans. These services include the development of individualized plans for employment. In fiscal year 2013, 598 of the individuals exiting an individualized plan for employment were employed upon exit. This represents 64% of the individuals that exited an individualized plan for employment. This was below the prior year performance of 637, but it was still the second highest year ever and still worth highlighting. Okay, now we're going to be looking a little bit at the history of the department's budget. These slides were provided by Legislative Finance and do a really great job of, as I said, looking at what the department has done over the years or how the department's budget has changed over the years. This slide, the bars on this slide show the department's general funds since FY 2006. General funds on this chart means unrestricted and designated general funds. So the designated general funds in the department include the State Training and Employment Program, which I think you're familiar with, and the Technical and Vocational Education Program, which is kind of an important one, as well as the Worker Safety Account and others. The blue line on this chart shows the department's general funds as a percentage of the state's overall general fund budget, which is 1.33% in FY 2015. Practically the same level as FY 2006 at 1.32%. Any questions? Oh, that's right, sorry. Okay. This next chart shows the department's budget by fund group. Federal funds is the blue, or no. Federal funds is the, I guess, purple color at the top. Has remained relatively flat over this time frame, increasing by $1.4 million. Other funds increased, which is the next group, increased by $1.4 million. Other state funds are primarily grants and contracts received from state agencies and non-state agencies. The department's designated general funds increased $7.9 million. Again, those are STEP and TVEP, which I spoke to earlier. And unrestricted general funds increased $18.6 million. This means that the state's percentage of the department's overall budget has grown. This next chart shows the department's budget by line item, and it helps to show what the department is doing with the funding. The majority of the department's budget supports personal services at 64%, which is that top bar, and grants at 32%. The remaining funding supports travel, contractual services, supplies, and equipment. It's good to know that the personal services, in a lot of cases, it's direct services to Alaskans through the job centers and through the vocational rehabilitation centers where we're serving disabled Alaskans. So it's not all administrative and overhead. And then the grants, a lot of the grants are workforce development grants to train Alaskans. So. The next chart, as we saw, the department's personal services budget has increased over $17 million since FY 2006. That was the previous slide. But at the same time frame, positions have gone down by 115. So it's a lot of the increase is related to bargaining unit cost increases and not that we are significantly growing staff. I think that's all I wanted to say on that chart. This chart shows the department's FY 2015 budget, which totals $185 million. This includes $95 million in federal funds, $34.4 million in unrestricted general funds, $34.1 million in designated general funds, and $21.8 million in other funds. The department's budget by core service is 7% protect workers, 29% income replacement, and 64% workforce development. The department has 109 full-time positions, 77 part-time positions, and 14 temporary positions. I did want to just mention that the unrestricted general funds of 34.4 is down $500,000 from the prior year. This slide shows the changes within the department's FY 2015 budget from the current year. The budget includes the deletion of 21 positions. 21 were related to reduced funding levels, totally $975,000. 10 of those positions were vacant for at least 2 years, and the other 10 may have been vacant for less than 10 years, but they were no longer supported with the funding levels that we have. This funding reduction included $246,800 in unrestricted general funds and $6,200 in designated general funds and $461,000 in federal funds. I might have said that right. The department also reduced uncollectible revenue authority in the amount of $4.9 million, which is a combination of federal and interagency receipts. And interagency receipts is that revenue from other state agencies. Within the Employment Security Division, we've asked for a $125,000 increment in Training and Building Fund authorization, which is designated general funds. This funding comes from penalties and interest associated with untimely payments of unemployment insurance contributions. This funding can be used to help support the Alaska Job Center Network. Alaska's Job Center Network is struggling to maintain operations while reduced federal and interagency funding levels. And this presents an opportunity when collections are up to use this revenue to support those operations. The next item on the list, one of the 21 positions deleted was the Gas Line Training Program Administrator within the Division of Business Partnerships. The unrestricted general funds that supported this position was also deleted. The agency recognizes the importance of the gas line work, and we're still committed to doing that work. Just we're, again, looking for efficiencies and doing things with other staff as we can. The last item on the list is the Technical Vocational Education Program, TVEP. And this is simply the increase to the TVEP recipients within the department's budget based on our projections of what the FY 2015 fund balance will be. And this assumes the current allocation in statute and would change as if that allocation were to change. The department's capital budget includes $8 million for the second phase of the Avtec heavy equipment diesel pipe welding relocation project. This phase will include building a replacement heavy equipment shop that will allow that program to be relocated from the existing facility with known life safety code and ADA deficiencies. The first phase was $6 million and was received in the current fiscal year. It is currently in the design and bid phase, and construction is expected to begin in the spring. The employment and training services, the second item on the list is deferred maintenance, Avtec deferred maintenance for $1 million. This is the fifth year of the governor's $100 million deferred maintenance initiative. Through that initiative, Avtec has been able to make considerable strides in reducing their deferred maintenance backlog. There's still work to be done. Projects include things like underground fuel tank replacements, baseboard heaters, and zone valve replacements, among others. The third item is $170,000 to establish the infrastructure for a public access network for the public computers in the job centers throughout Alaska. And this is necessary to move those computers off of the statewide area network. The next two charts are looking forward at the department's 10-year plan. The first slide is just looking at general funds, and again, in this instance, general funds means unrestricted and designated general funds. What we've shown here is it's hard to see the colors on there, but the purple line that goes out of the blue line the red line, which goes out of the blue line, is the department's 10-year plan, which shows a growth rate of about 1%. The green line is the 9-year annual growth rate since 06, which is 7.1%, and the purple line is our more moderated growth rate over the past 5 years of 1.2%, and you'll see that our 10-year plan is right along that more moderated growth rate, and it just shows our commitment to maintaining our costs, finding efficiencies where we can, and living within our means. The next slide shows all funds, and it's an interesting picture this year. Again, the red line is our 10-year plan. It shows a growth rate of 0.4%. If you were to look at all funds over the past 9 years, you'll see a growth rate of 1.9%. And if you looked at just the past 5 years, you'd see a negative 1% growth rate. And this is primarily related to the fluctuations we've seen in federal funds. The reason the department's 10-year plan shows a relatively flat rate is that we don't anticipate federal funds to grow like they might have done in earlier years. But we certainly hope they don't continue to decline as they have in more recent years. And that's all I have for you today.
So Representative Osterman, Representative Stoltz, thank you for this opportunity to present to you today. And we can take questions. I do have a few of the directors in the room here who can answer specific questions if you have them.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Bloomer, I have a question. The philosophy of your department, and you've had we're plowing a lot more money into Avtec and other state-sponsored and other entities sponsored. One thing that we seem to leave out is the private sector. And I think I've talked to them. I think they feel justifiably pretty left out this whole process. Are you comfortable with that exclusion of the private sector? looking at their efficiencies and job placements, training costs, and is a totally government-directed job training process the appropriate way to go? And usually the best people that help you train you and find jobs are people that actually have a job in the private, if that's what we're looking for. I mean, if we were doing a social worker training, I'd say probably a government entity would probably be the best. If we're training welders, carpenters, other craftsmen, why is, and please disabuse me and all the folks in the private sector training facilities that they're totally off base, and that this administration and others in the past haven't given them a fair chance. Please, here.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I will tell you that the department has done a lot of outreach to industry and businesses privately over the last year and a half. We have taken, for the first time ever, the AWIB board out to communities that they've not visited before. We visited Ketchikan and we visited Kenai. We invited private sector and industry folks to come have a panel before us and let us know what their needs were, what occupational areas that they were struggling in. We've done a little more outreach and tried to be more efficient with our granting process, recognizing that private industry doesn't always have the time and the luxury to go through all the paperwork to apply for our state grants. So we're looking at efficiencies in that area. We've reached out to an organization, Alaska Builders Contractors, who previously has felt neglected by this particular department, and incorporated them into some of our processes.
Is their neglect justified, their feelings?
I don't know that I can comment on that. Not since I've been on board, I don't believe there has been, and I can't comment on the past. But we have worked closely with ABC, reached out to many of the other organizations. Private industry trainers have received grants over the last year, and partnered with Carlisle and Northern Industry Training. So we have been reaching out to those folks. And so if you have particular folks that we should reach out to and talk to, we'd be happy to do that.
Well, actually it's kind of circuitous. I think you know who the folks are because they're pretty active. And they're the folks that are knocking at the door. But they do say that Commissioner Bloomer has improved the relationship, but. And it's good, you have the, and I don't mean pejorative, the milk and cookie tours and talking about, but it really comes down to where we put our resources and opportunities often doesn't match some of the field trip functions and stuff. If the decision's already been made, we can have all of those. That they're systemically excluded, then that's a real problem. And I don't bring this up lightly because these are the ones in my district and other districts. They put their own money up, and this isn't like a vouchers deal. There's not a constitutional prohibition. This is about providing training for people, and these are the only theology is their degree is, I think, a J-O-B, and that's probably the most important one. Beyond that, I don't know. I don't know that they do, I guess this is just start. I don't expect the answer today. To turn around years of neglect and really not having that very valuable component of our training opportunities excluded. Government isn't. If government could do things, we'd already have a pipeline. We'd already have we build all these government facilities and throw in all the money, but I see these private facilities. They want to talk and come and brag about how they do on job placements, how they compare on costs, how they are open to everybody. And it's I think we're really missing the boat. And in fairness, Commissioner, you're getting higher marks for your receptiveness, but how long does it take to turn around that super tanker in that small port, and how it's and if we already make we're going into phase three of, and I'm not trying to pick on a community, is Avtech our best investment for job training for Alaskans? I hear different stories from disabuse it, that it, the idea that it is. I think it has political considerations of why we put things in Seward, and those are real clear. And I guess we can say that's what we've always done. That's probably the worst way to do it. But I guess I probably have some friends at the table that might want to jump in. But this is a big part of your department's effort and outreach, and I think we haven't done a good enough job. But giving you credit that you are getting better marks for having an open door.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the, Representative Stoltz brought up AFTEC, and I know I had to do a little bit of work with this budget at one time. What is the cost per person to run an individual through a program at AFTEC?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, it depends on the program, frankly, and I could get
the welding program.
I can get Fred Esposito, who's here, to come up and tell you exactly what those numbers are. We did talk about those with our subcommittee the other night. So with your permission, I'll have Fred come up and address the AFTEC questions. Is that fair?
That's fair. When we get there, we can kind of go ahead if you want to do that now, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Newman.
You identify yourself.
Okay, sorry. Fred Esposito, Director of AFTEC. I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't have the number off the top of my head. We'll have to look at, you know, what all we want to include in that number, the overall cost of the facilities, cost of the training program, divided by the number of students that we produce on an annual basis. I would have to get back to you on that.
Sure, if I remember right, I think it was about $43,000 for a six-week program.
I wouldn't say that that's accurate. First of all, our welding program, the combination welding program is made up of two parts. The first part is structural welding, and that's 18 weeks. Second part is pipe welding, and that's a 14-week program. And so it would depend on which program, and it would depend on again, what all we're going to include in that number, but I can get that for you.
That's fine. And just one more towards AFTEC. We had asked the university, and Representative Munoz might remember this answer, but I believe it was a ratio of state funding to pupil funding is 25 to 1. I can't remember what the ratio was. So what is the ratio of state funding to pupil funding at AFTEC?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, the ratio of state funding to student funding?
Yes.
I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay. One more follow-up with a Hess question, if we can.
See if we can get an answer, him.
You're batting 0 for 3 right now.
I don't know if you got yours answered either.
Okay. That's my at-bat.
So this one is, I think, fairly easy. This morning we had a meeting with the Health and Social Services, and the question came up with how do the departments work together? And earlier in your presentation you talked about working with Health and Social Service issues. What are you doing to go out there and get low-income or in areas of the state where there is not a high unemployment rate, where there is a high unemployment rate, to go out there and get those people in need who need those jobs that are not applying for public assistance?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, there's various programs that we work with. Alaska Works Partnerships, if you're familiar with them, actually goes out and goes to rural Alaska to recruit folks into the apprenticeship programs. We have partnerships with the regional training centers and partnerships with many grantees. We are really focusing on, when I talked about the website that we're looking to put together to show what we have in each region, And then we'll be able to identify, and we are working on identifying, are there areas in the regions that are lacking? So did I answer your question? Did you get one just now?
So we're trying to reduce the cost and, you know, and try and get more people to work that are in need. So do you have a systematic approach of looking at areas where there's high unemployment, where there's areas of high need of public assistance, and try and go into those areas and develop job training programs, I guess, so they could get jobs, or what? Do you systematically look at that, those statistics, and try and develop opportunities there?
We do look at those statistics, and we do partner. Donlin Gold is a perfect example that of a workforce development plan that works in rural Alaska. So we do partner with those folks. Systematically, a plan for labor to go out into rural Alaska and target those needed areas. If there's not a job service center there, we partner with another entity because we don't have that kind of funding available.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I just wondered, did Mr. Esposito come up to assist you in your presentation on the Department of Labor's, or is he already here?
Through the Chair, Representative Stoltz, Mr. Esposito was here for the Alaska Workforce Investment Board meeting.
Well, good. At least we didn't burn a ticket on some. We could have gotten an unanswered by teleconference. So
I appreciate that. Thank
you. One good thing.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question on page 10. It's the slide showing the number of resident workers in Alaska, and we spend a lot of time in the building talking about Alaska Hire and what can we do to increase the hiring of Alaskans, and obviously there are constitutional limits to some of the things that we can do in this building, which really frustrates us no end. But this shows the numbers of resident workers over time. I was wondering, as a percentage of the total workforce, how are we doing in Alaska Hire? Is it going, are we a higher percentage of Alaskans compared to the total, lower? Holding steady.
I'm going to defer to Paloma because she's our number person through the chair. Sorry.
I thought that might come up. For the record, this is Paloma again with the Department of Labor. The non-resident worker count was also up. It totaled 83,488 in 2011 for an overall percentage of 20.1% of the workforce. We've been around that 2019% mark for the last several years.
So, Mr. Chairman, so we're holding more or less, I mean, all workforce is up, jobs are up, and it's kind of the proportions have been staying roughly the same.
Correct. That would be correct, yes.
Thank you.
Your Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner. So I just had some folks from the oil and gas industry in my office from my district, and they do a lot of work in Cook Inlet, and they say with the increased natural gas and oil activity in the inlet, they see companies like, I think they said Hillcorp, but I'm not sure, with their expansions, and they're just bringing up plane loads of workers from outside. And if I have the company name wrong, I apologize. But what they see in Cook Inlet is, with the expanded activity, just a massive expanse in people coming up from outside. And as I've sat on this committee, in my first couple years, I would hear answers as before your time, and I'd say, wow, things are going to be great next year. Wow, things sound great. Wow, things sound great. I guess, what are we doing to train people for sort of the roustabout work and the higher level work in the oil and gas industry? I mean, we had the pipeline training center for the pipeline we don't have. And I know they try to do other training that would be relevant. But really, what are we doing so that we're filling those jobs with trained Alaskans? So I mean, Representative Stoltz talked about Alaska Builders and Contractors, and
I didn't mention Alaska Builders and Contractors.
Did you not?
She did.
Okay. Well, anyway, the more I find myself agreeing with Representative Stoltz, the more I realize he's thinking more like a Democrat. So I understand that. But
With a small D.
God forbid people found out how much we agreed on stuff. Yeah, what are we doing to fill those jobs, like the roustabout and above jobs in Cook Inlet, for example, with Alaskan workers? And what are we doing different than what we were doing before? Because right now, it's the same old story. New companies come up, and it's outside workers.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think you do have the company name right, and we are meeting with them tomorrow. We've been meeting with companies down on the Kenai, and that's primarily why we took the Alaska Workforce Investment Board down there. We had Hillcorp, Udelhoven, two others that are escaping me at the very moment, come in and talk to us about what the needs were. And across the board, what we've heard from industry, we were expecting to hear about some skill gap, some major needs for training. And what we heard was people are lacking, the folks coming in to the workforce are lacking soft skills. And I had to question exactly what that meant, and it's basically work ethics. We're having difficulties. We're finding barriers to folks coming to work. And we had to regroup and try to think about what Department of Labor's role in that is. But what we are doing in a positive light, we're meeting with each individual company as we hear that they're increasing the need for an increased workload. And there's a program down there for roustabouts under the MSHA program down there through the university that we provide some granting for as well. And part of the problem is we're all under this theory that, or we're under this guise that we train for employment. We don't train just to train. And I think that this committee would probably agree that that's what those funds are designated for. And so what we find ourselves in is a catch-up stage. The jobs come open, and we're not training quickly enough. So we're working with there's a new lead down there, Bill Bieber, and we've met with him a few times to see how can we beef up the programs down there to produce more workers more quickly.
Through the chair. Shorter question this time.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Let me two questions. Number one, do you think it's going to make a major difference over what hasn't happened in the last many, many, many years, and why? And then number two, would this not be an amazing opportunity? I mean, we've got two problems in the state. One, outside workers filling Alaska jobs. Number two, especially rural economies with the lack of an income base. And is there an effort to train rural workers for these jobs too? A strong effort, not just, you know, an every once in a while effort, but a really strong effort. You know, if folks can work 2 weeks at Pebble or 2 weeks on the North Slope, they can work 2 weeks in Cook Inlet too.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we do put a strong effort out there. We encourage to our grantees to do that. The Job Service Center in Kenai particularly is very, very involved in with industry down there and engaged with industry down there. When we first started hearing from a former senator that we had missed the boat on the Kenai, we started really focusing down there, saying, what do we need to do? How do we get there? And what we found was disappointing, and that was they weren't utilizing our Job Service Center. So we've had our Job Service Center folks doing more outreach, independent visits, and attending many more functions to learn what those needs really are. So at this point, I would say in Kenai and through rural Alaska, we do know that that's an important mission of this department, and we are doing as much outreach as we can currently. And I just have to say, more this year than when I first got on board. So,
do we need more centers, more workplaces? I mean, more training centers, or
I think that Representative Osterman, I believe that we really need to focus on what the target industry needs are right now, and we need input from industry. We've been collecting that information. I believe that we will need more training facilities. If both of the large projects take off that are anticipated. and Don Lingle being one of those.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. The governor's proposal, education proposal, includes a dual credit requirement for TVET money, for institutions that receive TVET money. And I know that the university already provides dual opportunities, high school and post-secondary. How will the regional training centers meet that requirement? And has AVTEC begun to formulate a plan to make their programs available to high school students?
Do you want to answer that? Okay. Representative Osterman, through the chair, Representative Munoz, we will work closely with the regional training centers. Some of them have been doing some digital coursework already, and others we will have to work closely with, but we believe with participation from the school districts and the regional training centers, with partnership from Department of Education and Department of Labor, that can happen. We're hoping to have a program similar to the Running Start program that Washington has recently started to give the students a head start when they actually leave high school. You want to talk about AVTEC?
Sure.
Identify yourself.
Again, Fred Esposito, Director of AVTEC. Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we actually have started over the last 5 or 6 years to provide high school level training via distance delivery, dual credited in most cases where the school district allows for that. We work with the school districts to give them all the information they need to provide dual credit. The biggest course that we have been providing is nautical skills, and it's a preparatory introductory class for students interested in maritime careers, and it's been available for dual credit.
Can I follow up on that? Are there major school districts that don't participate in that program? And if so, how can we get them on board?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I believe that we've been working with about 12 school districts, mostly rural school districts, but also the Kenai School District as well, perhaps through the Digital Learning Center network that is being created here at the University of Alaska Southeast. Perhaps we can get the word out to more school districts about that program.
Okay. Okay, and then one more follow-up question. Okay. On the capital request, if you could speak to the $8 million for the that particular project, where is it and what is it?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, that project is a three-phase project. Phase one is underway right now to replace the diesel shop, and phase two will replace the heavy equipment shop. So that we will be able to vacate that existing shop that was built in the early 1970s. We've had three engineering firms confirm to us that that building is a dangerous and potentially hazardous facility. So we've been trying to replace that facility for quite some time. We're currently in the design phase on the diesel shop. It will be a design build project put out by the Department of Transportation and should be underway this summer.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left for the department, and I've got three people. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was watching the this committee on Gavel to Gavel, and the other day I called you Mr. Speaker. So, just a couple statements, and then I got a question on slide 8. When they tell you they can't find qualified elections or give excuse for Alaskans not wanting to live up to their standard, I just tell you that's the excuse du jour. You know, I've seen many people get off the plane and look at our weather or our conditions and say, I'm out of here. You know, that's construction for more than 25 years. You know, if there are big projects in the state start ramping up and then we think we're going to start training people at that point, it's kind of too late. But on the graph on page 8 that you have up here, there's a delightful trend down. We have some of the most dangerous and remote jobs that we have, that there are, between, you know, timber and construction, oil and gas and fisheries. Could you talk about this trend line down, which is really good to see? and where those are and those categories are, and what do you attribute that to?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, this is Gray Mitchell. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Department of Labor and also hold the role of the Director of Labor Standards and Safety Division, which includes the Occupational Safety and Health Office. And this is the office that's really responsible primarily for a lot of this reduction. Of course, it's a combination effort. You know, without the private sector participating, which they have a vested interest to do, workers' comp costs are the highest in the nation in Alaska. So, you know, they're driven. Our staff that go and do inspections are driven to find issues and get them corrected. We produce a program through our consultation and training section, which, you know, it's kind of the hidden gem of the occupational safety and health system, because when you mention that word many times, especially on a construction site, you know, people run away kind of screaming and waving their arms. But this consultation and training program is actually a very positive-oriented program, and I think through that program we've seen some tremendous gains through our positive reinforcement of an employer's request to have assistance, where essentially they will say, we want you to come in and take a look at our business operation, identify all the hazards, tell us what we need to do to fix them. Then they go through a step-by-step process to assist that and make sure it happens. Along the way, the consultation process involves all of the employees at that work site and talks to the workers about being safe and following procedures. And, you know, this is, I think, the result of a combined effort between government, private sector, and individual workers themselves taking responsibility.
Thank you. Just to follow through. So in the dozen years you have up there, where are the most effective places that we've seen the reduction in lost time accidents? Is it in flipping on the grill at a quick stop, or is it in the oil fields or in the fisheries, or where are we seeing that? If you broke that down by industry, what would it look like?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we focus on three primary industries: construction, transportation and warehousing, and seafood processing. Those three categories have historically had higher than average illness and injury rates in the work sites. And we've actually seen tremendous improvements in construction and transportation and warehousing. This last year, we saw a flat result in seafood processing, but if you compare it to the last decade, seafood processing has come a long way as well. We are focusing additional efforts in seafood processing, and over this last year, through a partnership with one of the largest seafood processors in Alaska, we developed a training course that's designed specifically at the hazards related to seafood processing and the seasonality of the workforce in that industry. And over the last year, over 1,000 workers received training, and we're expecting that to jump probably tenfold, because once we implement that training in a particular facility, the expectation is that the employer will then continue that training program forward. So we're expecting the number to drop tremendously in seafood processing, which will also continue to have a positive impact on the overall rate. But clearly, those three categories are the highest sectors of the industries in Alaska, not the people flipping burgers necessarily, but the people who are out there doing industrial types of activities.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say I wrote down everybody's questions, so we'll make sure we do those on the subcommittee. Back to not having silos. If our children aren't coming to school on time and we have an attendance problem in schools, it's probably why we have an attendance problem when it gets to the workforce. So I guess I just want to remind people they're working with the adults, and I think not that the adults can't be taught that too, but it's another problem we have in our schools. But if you have any other concerns, I'll come see the ones that wrote them down. Let me know. We'll make sure that we cover them in the subcommittee.
Thank you, and I appreciate that comment because it dovetails with mine. In the education world, we call that habits of mind, and you had mentioned that the work ethic was where you found some issues with people not getting to work on time, perhaps, and all of the things that in education we call habits of mind. And that is something that actually can be built into an assessment rubric so that teachers are actually including that as part of their how they assess student work. And so I would just encourage you to work with the Department of Education wherever you can, because so many of our departments and the work that you're doing interact with another department. That brings me to a question. I represent a district in Anchorage which has the largest high school in the state, and I come from a district that has the most students in the entire state. And one of the questions I received from a teacher at a high school in my district is whether or not the Department of Labor can actually be in the schools working with students as the job counselors. And can you respond to that question?
Representative Costello, through the chair. Yes, we have career counselors that that are not located in the schools, but are part of their duties and functions are to visit the schools. There's three career guides that are actually physically located at the King Career Center, and they go into schools in the Anchorage School District to talk about to develop personal learning career paths and work with the students on guidance counseling for employment. Three career guides in the entire Anchorage School District, though, is not many. So, yes, they are available to go into the schools, and they do get out and about into the school districts.
If I could put you in touch with the principal, would you be willing to speak with her about possibly having one of those career counselors visit the school? Because I know that with the budget cuts they've received, that seat is vacant, and they have a volunteer there for just, you know, a portion of the week. So I think that would go a long way towards helping the students not have to find transportation to the King Career Center after school and get that FaceTime with somebody who can actually help them with their job prospects. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Last question, Representative Newman.
Ms. Chair, before Representative Newman goes, I had a whole bunch of questions. I appreciate the invitation by Representative Wilson. I'll have a punch list for her, and I hope other folks do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I received some further information from Legislative Finance to follow up on what I was working on earlier, some of the questioning. The unregulated general fund ratio to tuition ratio at AFTEC is about 70% UGF, 30% tuition. The university runs at about a dollar tuition to $1.25 UGF. I think it's been hit about $1.28. In discussions I've had with the president of the university and a former director at Department of Labor when I oversaw Labor's budget, we talked about considerations of moving AFTEC under the university's veil. So we're not duplicating administrative services and such like that. They both felt that would probably be very practical and we could reduce the cost at AFTEC. If you ever talked to the university or the president about that, and would you consider doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I have not talked with the president of the university about that. I'm always open to new ideas. I will say that AVTEC is currently reviewing the tuition rates and comparing them to other training centers or voc tech centers to determine if there is not an across-the-board tuition increase needed, but program-by-program tuition increase needed, so that we are more sustainable while still maintaining an affordable tuition for folks. I will say that I believe that some of the rural communities or some of the rural students find AFTEC a little more attractive coming into a smaller community and having just a smaller, not so intimidating environment when they arrive. I've heard from many of the folks, including if you're familiar with the ANSET program, that's one of their successful components. Although they work through the university, it's a smaller program where the kids don't feel lost or the students don't feel lost when they actually come into the university program. So I guess that would be the few comments that I'd say, but I'm happy to listen to ideas, certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate you and your staff giving us the information. So with that, We will now go into the presentation from the Alaska Mental Health Authority. If Jesse, you want to come forward and bring your esteemed colleagues with you. And good afternoon, Mr. Martin. Thank you for joining us today. I'll turn it over to you.
I'm Mike Martin. We could have the next slide. I'm the chair of the Board of Trustees for Mental Health Trust. We have a number of hardworking trustees here with me, including Lorraine Durer, Paula Easley, Mary Jane Michael, and Russ Webb. All dedicated to helping with the trust authority and keeping Jeff out of mischief. The trust beneficiaries, as you can see on the screen, are very diverse, those with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism, substance abuse disorder, Alzheimer's and related dementia, and traumatic brain injury. The goal or the guiding principles for the trust to improve the lives of beneficiaries are education of the public and policymakers, collaboration with various advocates. We're going to maximize beneficiary input into the programs and to prioritize services for beneficiaries at risk of institutionalization. And we need useful and timely data for evaluation, and we need to include intervention and prevention components in our programs. And we need to provide for reasonably necessary beneficiary services based on ability to pay. We have a number of advisors and partners, some of which were set up in enabling statutes. You can see on the screen here who they are. The first four are statutory advisors, those that were established in statute to help the Mental Health Board of Trustees to manage the programs. The trust cash assets for as of fiscal 13 are displayed on this slide. You can see the various components. Our cash assets are managed primarily by the permanent fund and to a small component of those also by the Department of Revenue. We have our non-cash assets, which are managed by the Trust Land Office in the Department of Natural Resources. And this slide shows our land portfolio. I would like to point out to the pie chart on the right, you'll see that we only have full fee ownership of slightly more than half of the land, so that if we cannot develop the minerals on the 45% that's left, it's of absolutely no use to the trust. So you can, going back a second, you can see at the bottom of the page the contributions of the non-cash assets to the trust is a total of $157 million over the life of the trust. The available income for fiscal 15 is displayed here. You can see that the payout, which is based on 4.25% of the net asset value of the cash assets in the trust, plus prior year payout that wasn't utilized by the grantees or the recipients, plus the average spendable income generated by the trust land office, and then interest on our checking account. So we expect a total payout in fiscal 15 of around $26.5 million for beneficiaries. The trust established in an effort to organize our efforts, we established focus areas, and you can see on the screen the five focus areas that have been utilized for a number of years in distributing the payout. The first is to bring the kids home, and if we can back up one, Jeff, we rehearsed this. This has been a very successful effort on the part of the trust and other partners, and in fact, we're planning on phasing out this focus area because we have brought the kids home. And I think that's something we can all be very proud of. In the disability justice focus area, the trust in its evaluation this past year has decided to continue our efforts in that arena at approximately the same level. The housing area, we want to expand the effort there and put a new emphasis on long-term care services and support. In the beneficiary projects focus area, we want to expand that and include a new emphasis on beneficiary employment. And we want to continue to our efforts in the workforce development focus area at approximately the same level. And we will add a new focus area in alcohol and substance abuse, but I'll ask Jeff to go through each focus area and show you how the investments have paid off.
For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. So to start with, what does this look like when it works? When we're actually able to turn the curve on a problem that you have identified that you wanted to solve. And this is an epitome of a program that actually worked. When we started out, we had 437 kids out of state. You were spending over $40 million a year out of state to serve these kids, and that number was continuing to go up at a pretty constant rate for the 5 years before we started this initiative. When we were able to pull folks together, different departments, different regions of the state, our tribal partners, and start looking at how to do business differently, we were able to start turning that curve and basically using the funds that you were sending out of state to invest in state to provide services to those kids. And yesterday we were down to 94 kids out of state. So that's a very significant reduction. And you can see that the trust role over this period of time was to basically be the venture capital and the money that ran the initiative, developed the evaluation procedures, pulled folks together. When we found a promising practice, for example, in Maine, we were able to fly people from DJJ, Division of Behavioral Health, North Star, both our private and our public partners, actually fly them to Maine so that they could talk to the programs and understand how that program worked in that location and then bring that technology back to Alaska. The trust spent over the period of time over $16 million in trust funds in order to facilitate the development of this initiative. And as Chair Barton said, basically this is our last year of Bring the Kids Home, FY15. However, unlike what we did in previous times, by the way, we've solved this out-of-state problem once before. It was called the Alaska Youth Initiative. And a lot of the strategies were the same ones we used for the Alaska Youth Initiative. Our mistake at the time was to move on without leaving a data collection system that could identify when it started to go south again. And just frankly, it got away from us. And so this time, we are leaving those data, I call them tripwires, so that as we go forward, if we start to see these numbers go the other way again, if we see the expenditures on out-of-state services go up again, we can intervene ahead of time, earlier, to try to turn that curve before we end up with $40 million and 400 kids out of state.
Before we go any further, I wanted to give a shout-out to someone of the legislative leaders, Senator Lyda Green. I fervently hope she's not listening to us and she's doing something more entertaining, but I know a lot of her friends and family do it. I want to recognize her as one of the legislative and moral leaders of this effort.
Yep. Senator Green absolutely was there in the beginning. In fact, it's interesting, one of the, I think, values of the trust is this initiative was actually started in the Murkowski administration with Joel Gilbertson. And as administrations change, as you know, priorities can change and efforts can wane and wax. With the trust partnering on an initiative like this, you get a degree of continuity that you don't necessarily get if you rely on just the executive branch to carry through. Disability justice. Well, is this investing wisely? I use this slide because this slide was presented to the legislature in January of 2009. And what ICER did is it drew a dotted line in blue that would show if the legislature and the executive branch really didn't do anything differently, what could you expect in terms of prison construction and costs associated with housing inmates? The red dotted line was what you could do if you invested in a series of strategies to try to turn the curve and basically reduce recidivism. Well, unfortunately, you are right on target for the blue line. You are on schedule to need to construct a new 1,500-bed prison in 2018. So in that sense, ICER was right on the ball. You are definitely on track to continue to make that kind of investment in the future. And as my subcommittee chair for Health and Social Services tells me on a regular basis, we have to start cutting these costs down the road, or we don't have a sustainable budget, not just for the Department of Corrections, but for any of our departments. So is there something that you can do about this? Well, why do we care so much about this? Why does the Mental Health Trust care so much about the Department of Corrections and inmates? Well, 42% of the inmates in the Department of Corrections are trust beneficiaries. 38% of the beneficiaries, or actually 38% of all inmates, could qualify as beneficiaries solely because of their alcohol diagnosis. 26% of all inmates in corrections could qualify as a beneficiary based on their mental health diagnosis. It also gives you an idea of the scope of dual diagnosis here, as there are many, many inmates that have both mental health and substance abuse problems. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, when you look at recidivism and length of stay of trust beneficiaries, you find that whether they're sentenced or not sentenced, trust beneficiaries not only stay longer in corrections, but they recidivate at a higher rate. So we own a big chunk of this problem, and we recognize that, and we want to work with you to turn that curve that ICER showed. Well, we have shown some successes. The Bridge Home program, which targets people coming out of API or corrections with intensive community services, has shown dramatic reductions both in admissions to corrections, admissions to API, and number of days that they've been in those institutions. The problem is the trust can't fund the heavy lifting to take these types of programs to scale. This is just 55 people. We need to do 555, maybe even 5,055. But the point is, only the legislature can take this as well as other strategies to scale. What it takes ultimately, and I really appreciated the comments that Representative Wilson made a few days ago, what it takes is active partnership of various agencies. And one thing that frustrates me is I go to these criminal justice working group meetings, and the Chief Justice is there, and the Attorney General, and the Department of Law, and the Public Defender, and Corrections, and they sit around and they say, well, we've got to reduce recidivism. And I go, well, you guys aren't the solution to recidivism. You're the people that put people in there. The people that are going to change the curve on recidivism are the Department of Labor, AHFC, Health and Social Services. Those people are the ones that have to get in the room and decide that, hey, we are going to keep these people from going back into prison. And one thing I will give a shout out, I don't know if the commissioner is still here, but yesterday when I went to the Criminal Justice Working Group, who was sitting right there but Commissioner Bloomer? This is not a big priority in her department's history, but she's very passionate about doing something about recidivism and takes her own time to come to the Criminal Justice Working Group and contribute to trying to look at how to change this curve. And one thing I will say is it's interesting the comment about pulling these different agencies together. You know, the reason we have a mental health bill is that under the settlement, the idea was that we wouldn't silo different parts of the state's mental health program, that we would get a look at the comprehensive integrated mental health program. And we thought, well, this is going to be so cool because the legislature can now pull folks together and look at all these different pieces, the corrections piece, the health and social service piece, the university piece, all of these different pieces. And what was the first thing that happened? The legislature broke it back up into each of the individual silos and takes the mental health bill, splits it into silos, sends it to different subcommittee chairs. They operate independently of each other, at least seemingly so. And then it all gets put back together in this supposed comprehensive integrated mental health program. Well, it's not. So one thing I might suggest is not only do we need to get the departments working together, but it might be good to get the subcommittee chairman that have some of these different departments to get together and say, hey, I hear we need to turn this recidivism thing around. Maybe it's time for Representative Thompson, Representative Newman, Representative Wilson, to sit down and say, hey, how can we get our departments to work together and charge them with a mission of turning the curve on recidivism or whatever problem you want to deal with. It doesn't necessarily have to be this issue, but any issue. I think that that's a model for really leading from the front, so to speak, in putting some of this together. One thing we are concerned about is the existing behavioral health infrastructure. In recent months, we have had a number of agencies, one very major one in Fairbanks, that went bankrupt. We were barely able to save Denali Family Services, which was our largest provider of adolescent treatment in the state, and would have dealt a serious blow to the Bring the Kids Home initiative. The trustees were forced to make a $200,000 no-interest short-term loan in order to salvage that agency. Right now, we believe there are four other behavioral health agencies that are experiencing some real difficulty in survival. Now, we're looking at this. The department has a Myers and Stauffer study that's supposed to look at reimbursement rates. The trustees are funding a behavioral health systems assessment in response to both Commissioner Struer and Representative Newman to really find out what are we getting as outcomes for the money that we're investing in behavioral health. Why would you keep putting money into these programs if you don't know what you're getting out and what our capacity to turn these curves are? The grant reductions do threaten the stability of the behavioral health system, and why is that? We do not believe, although I think the commissioner would take some issue with this, but we do not believe that the Medicaid reimbursement rate is adequate to cover the cost of each unit of service. Now, the reason that's so important is it means that these agencies have to use their grant dollars not to serve the folks that are neither Medicaid eligible or have insurance, but for the uninsured. They have to use those grant dollars to supplement the Medicaid reimbursement in order to afford that unit of service. So every time you reduce the grant line, remember that you're not just reducing services to people that are unresourced, you're also reducing the ability of those agencies to bill Medicaid because they don't have the supplemental funding they need to make up the loss that they have on every unit of service where they bill Medicaid. We're trying to look harder at this in order to get some real firm numbers that we can bring to you, but this is a major concern. And the cost of these safety net failures is significant. When the Fairbanks Community Behavioral Health Center closed, 10 residents of Fairbanks had to move to Anchorage. A couple of them, they tried to place an API. So that's the first problem. We lost all 5 units of housing for people with mental illness in Fairbanks. That's 35 rooms and apartments. 42 jobs were lost as they had to reduce the workforce in order to restructure the budget. 700 people were receiving services prior to closure. Currently, only 300 could be served. And it costs more than $350,000 just to restart the services in Fairbanks with a new provider. So these safety net failures are not cheap, both from a programmatic standpoint and from a fiscal standpoint as well. As Chairman Barton mentioned, the trustees have set a new emphasis on long-term services and supports. Again, one of the reasons that we've done this is to try to get ahead, and I know Commissioner Struer, when he was here, talked about the silver tsunami. We have a greatly aging population. That segment of the population is the fastest growing segment demographically in the state. And so what we're looking at is how do we ramp up particularly those low cost services that engage the family and community in serving these individuals rather than relying on higher end institutional costs. So that's home health care, that's those local services, supporting caregivers, to try to keep people in their home, in their community, absolutely as long as possible. And so you'll see some of our budget recommendations are designed to get as much ahead of that curve as we possibly can. In addition, a new emphasis on beneficiary employment. As we move forward and budgets get tighter, our beneficiaries are going to have to do absolutely everything they possibly can to be as self-sufficient as possible. Now, unfortunately for many of our beneficiaries, they have to be very careful because if they make too much money, they can get kicked off of benefits such as Medicaid. And if you're looking at, say, psychotropic medications for your mental illness, that can run $700, $800 a month, you cannot afford to lose Medicaid, especially if your employment opportunity is around minimum wage. And so we're doing a lot of work with private business to encourage them to hire our beneficiaries. And if I can make this work. I might need technical assistance. Oh, the black.
Instead of kind of harassment through disability, you know, trying to do the right thing, it didn't take long to realize we were benefiting just as much as our new employees.
When you hire an Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job,
You're providing the opportunity for them to show their unique skills, work ethic, and desire to succeed.
Hiring people with disabilities has been great for employee morale, great for our community, and most importantly, great for our patients.
Matsu Regional.
Yeah, that is Matsu Regional. And they
recognize, I've met some of those folks.
Well, they've been fantastic. The CEO there, you know, it's the classic story where you had to kind of convince him, and then once these employees start showing up, and you talk about work ethic, you know, I'll never forget, just as an aside, Larry Baker, I'm sure many of you know Larry Baker, he used to run the Burger King. And I remember when Larry Baker talked to me about hiring people with developmental disabilities. He said, you know, I used to hire all these teenagers, and they'd show up late, they'd spend most of their shift hitting on each other, and then when I gave them a check, they'd complain because they weren't making any money, and then they'd be gone in 3 or 4 months, and I had to hire somebody else. And he says, now I hire people with disabilities, and you know what? They take the bus, they show up on time every day. They don't care how many hamburgers they make, and they are cheerful as all get out to get a check, and they'll work for me forever. And so if we can use this advantage that our beneficiaries in many cases have, we think there are tremendous opportunities to get way more of our beneficiaries employed. So we're working very hard in this area as well. We've also been working in this area with microenterprise. The trustees have invested a lot of money in microenterprise. Some of them are great. In Sitka, there's a guy that's going to do a pedicab deal for the summer, and he's going to give tourists rides in his pedicab. Perfect job for him. We've got a young woman who has started an alpaca farm, and she loves these alpacas and takes care of them and feeds them, and you know what? Alpaca fur is really valuable stuff. And so we're looking at how can we get even some of our beneficiaries that might not fit well in the workplace, how can we get them engaged in productive economic opportunities as well. As Chairman Barton mentioned, the trustees have also started a new focus area on the impacts of alcohol and substance abuse. And believe me, we have not undertaken this lightly. Many people before us have spent a lot of time and a lot of money trying to do something about the negative effects of alcohol. But there is a tremendous alignment right now in the state. If you ever want to do something to mitigate the negative, both community and budgetary impacts of alcohol, now is the time. Because in my 34 years up here, I have never seen this kind of coordinated effort from both the public and the private sector. You have not only the trustees now having identified this as a focus area, but the Rasmussen Foundation has developed the Recover Alaska partnership with people from across the state. The Matsu Health Foundation has conducted their community gatherings, and surprise, surprise, what did they learn out of 22 community gatherings in Matsu? Alcohol and behavioral health, number one issue of health in those communities, and they've now identified it as an emphasis. There is a statewide Alaska Wellness Coalition that's putting together positive community norms campaign. You know, not trying to beat up on people that have these problems, but use the fact that, for example, most kids do not binge drink. The negative advertising of the past has not been effective. And so we're using new science, new strategies to encourage people towards positive behaviors rather than just beat up on negative behaviors. The Alaska Resiliency Partnership is very critical. And I know that Representative Wilson, when we were in Matsu in Wasilla, you talked about prevention and early intervention. How do we get at these problems from the very earliest point? Well, what this has done is taken the knowledge we have now about adverse childhood experiences and how to build resiliency into kids from the very beginning. And I'll tell you, this research, if you haven't seen it, you would find it fascinating. You can count how many adverse childhood experiences a child has had and you can predict their negative behaviors and consequences years down the road. And it's not just the things you would expect, you know, like addiction, delinquency. It's things like heart disease and hypertension and other conditions that you wouldn't normally associate with those types of activities. And so this is huge. And then Empowering Hope, you'll hear more about in the coming weeks, I think. This is an effort being led by Senator Kelly on the Senate side as co-chair of Senate Finance. And I'm not going to jump the gun, but he has some pretty exciting ideas for some things to try to drive down some of the negative impacts of alcohol. Well, how negative are these impacts? A couple of years ago, we had the McDowell Group do a study on what is the annual cost of alcohol in Alaska. $1.2 billion in economic impact. Now, 670-some thousand of that is lost productivity. You talk about work ethic, about people coming to work. Well, they're not doing very well if they're hungover. They're either missing work or they're showing up hungover. You want to drive down your workplace accidents and illnesses even farther. Let's try to get people to stop overindulging in alcohol. It's not a prohibitionist thing. It's just we're trying to knock down those negative consequences of overconsumption. Now, on the left-hand side, these are the numbers that should really worry you because these are the costs that you see in your budgets. $237 million for health care, $217 million for criminal justice and protective services. If you look at OCS, if you look at DJJ, and, of course, the corrections budget is hugely driven by alcohol, excessive alcohol use. So that's why we're so focused on it. Of course, the solutions have to be comprehensive, just like they were with Bring the Kids Home. You got to do prevention. You got to do harm reduction. You know, this is even challenging some of the sector's belief. You know, for years, the gold standard in alcohol treatment programs has been abstinence. If you didn't get somebody stone cold sober, your program was a failure. Well, we're leaving that behind because there are some people that you may not get stone cold sober, but they still have significant costs to the budget. A chronically homeless individual in Anchorage runs about $100,000 a year. Now, some of those are soft costs, what I call soft costs, because it's the fire department and the police department spending time hauling them around instead of doing the things they should be doing. But some are hard costs. They get most of their health care at the ER. You know, we're paying for that, if not directly, then through all of our insurance premiums being higher as we pay for all that uncompensated care. Of course, expansion of access to treatment, really looking at our tribal partnerships. You know, the tribal health system has a tremendous capacity to assist further in this area if we will support them. And as the commissioner and others have pointed out, at 100% federal reimbursement, there's a lot of incentive to get our tribal partners more fully engaged in this effort. And they are, by the way, engaged in the Recover Alaska movement and in other areas. So it's not like they aren't playing, but they're an essential partner. And then environmental strategies. When the controversy over moving the Alcohol Beverage Control Board bubbled up, we moved it from public safety to commerce and economic development. One of the things that was revealed in all of that is that our population-based alcohol beverage control system, if you will, has been eroded steadily but relentlessly over time. As when we hit the limit for how many licenses you could have of a particular type, well, we just had a law and added another type. And so now you can have all kinds of licenses. You can have, in fact, my personal favorite is the remote military contractor license. If you have a military construction contract in a remote area, you can get a license to supply alcohol to your workers. And it goes on and on. Recreational licenses, golf course licenses, resort licenses. And so the board agreed to pull industry and public health people together to try to take a look at Title IV and see if we can't do something that, you know, accommodates the industry's legitimate and legal business opportunity, but also restore some consistency and some public health parameters around this legal but potentially very damaging substance. We'll talk more about this in the subcommittee. One of the things we've been working with you on, we're still working on this, is the Complex Behavior Collaborative. You can see how the trust for 12 and 13 negotiated some funding matches. Through FY14, we've been working on OTIs, one-time increments, all this way. It's still not in the governor's budget. And so we'll be talking to our subcommittee about this. Well, what's the outcome? Why is everybody talking about this darn Complex Behavior Collaborative? Well, the problem is we have these folks that are in assisted living, the Pioneer Home, in their natural home, and they end up with behaviors that are getting them kicked out. And when they get kicked out of wherever they are, they move up the chain. No one ever moves out into a cheaper level of service. They always move out into a more expensive level of service. So the idea is, before they get kicked out, what if we could bring some state-of-the-art, evidence-based behavior programming training to the people that have them now and see if we can't get them stabilized in their current placement, which has two benefits. Not only do you keep that person where they are and prevent them from going up the chain, but you raise the overall level of ability and talent of that provider, so the next person that shows up has a better chance of stabilizing in that environment because the staff is better trained. Well, here's an example. For FY13, which are the only numbers we can get, because apparently this MMIS seems to have some problems. Maybe you know something about that. Anyway, the numbers that we can get for FY13 shows that before people went into the Complex Behavior Collaborative, their costs for these 14 people were $600,000. After, this cost was $400,000 for these 14 individuals. And we spent $12,000 per client that was in it. Now, the reason I broke these other two colors out is look at what happened when the CBC failed. I mean, it doesn't work for everybody. Look at what happened when it failed. One of them, in yellow, went to an ICFMR out of state, $140,000 a year, bang. And that person is going to be there for who knows how long. The other person ended up in a residential psychiatric treatment center, an adolescent, $89,000 a year, bang. Now, this $200,000 difference here isn't just this year. I mean, now that you stabilize these people, you're saving $200,000 every year. Well, next year when we do another 15 people, you see how the math works here. I don't know what to do. I know it's so hard for us to come and say, you got to spend more money. You know, and you notice I never say things anymore like, you know, for every dollar you spend on prevention, you save $6. Because every time I said that, you would say, here's my dollar, where do I cut the budget $6? And it doesn't work like that. And so what we're trying to do is demonstrate that, yes, these investments do control your health care costs long term, but you have to decide to fund them. Here's the complete set of trustee recommendations for the general mental health budget. As you can see, virtually every one of these is designed to try to get some control over long-term spending. The Complex Behavior Collaborative, mental health clinical positions in the Department of Corrections, traumatic and acquired brain injury. These folks, if they don't get case management, they end up in all kinds of trouble and problems. The AHECs, these last two are trying to work at that silver tsunami. And I know there's a lot of concern about, gee, the trust starts all these great programs, and then they turn around and they try to transfer it all over to the general fund. In fact, a prominent legislator at one time told me, the problem with you guys is you start these programs and too many of them work. Well, this is the sum total of our recommendations to move from mental health funding over to general fund. The trauma-informed care at DJJ, and by the way, you want to talk about adverse childhood experiences and the difference that trauma-informed care can make. When Barb Henjum at DJJ started implementing training for trauma-informed care in her detention unit, their seclusion and restraint and acting out behavior went through the floor. I encourage you to go to McLaughlin and go to those units and talk to lifetime employees of DJJ that will say, this was a game changer, absolutely a game changer. And other states have done that kind of trauma-informed activity in their schools. This isn't just a DJJ thing. If you have ever wondered how much it makes sense to take a kid who's acted out and then expel them and suspend them so they can act out full time, this is an alternative way of trying to look at dealing with some of those issues. Thank you.
Mike, you got any comments before we go to questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're pleased to answer any questions that you might have.
Yeah. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, and welcome to the trustees, Mr. Webb, Mr. Barton, and Easley, and Durr, Ms. Easley, and Ms. Durr. You're my favorite of the boards because I appreciate your commitment and the expertise and personal connections you bring, and I appreciate Larry Noreen's involvement. Notwithstanding other people's assessments, I think we're lucky to have a guy who is so knowledgeable on the commercial real estate market in Alaska and in Anchorage, and I will defend him in any forum and his ability to do good things on behalf of the beneficiaries and his record for the people of Alaska. I appreciate all of the trustees' involvement, and special shout out to Larry Noreen, who lives in Representative Reinbold's district, but when you're anywhere nearby, you're a neighbor where I live. Substance abuse is a big concern. You're very active in making your views known on alcohol and other concerns. What do you think about marijuana? Is that going to throw another thing on your docket? There's a softball. And that's to the trustees.
That's a grown-up question.
Take it under consideration. But will the trustees... Is that a policy issue you might discuss? Or I'm not trying to drag you into it, but I'm looking at as a curiosity, as a voter. You guys are dealing with these issues. I know President Obama thinks it's pretty benign compared, and I don't know. I'm not a mental health expert like he is, and a substance abuse expert. But
the trustees have not discussed that. As of yet, it could fall under the area of substance abuse. If it's like alcohol and it gets abused, then it would come under that focus area.
And if it's in benign, you might endorse it, right?
Well, I would.
I'm just curious.
10-10.
Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Well, thank you, through the chair, Jeff. I hate to be the one to let you know this, but we are the budget subcommittee. I just wanted to say we've had a lot of hearings since session has started, and truly some of the best news, the only good news I can really point to is the Bring the Kids Home campaign, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank the trust and the trustees and your efforts in that. You know, when you hear bad news every day, the good news certainly stands out. So thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Welcome. And also my former constituent, Ms. Easley. I hope you'll keep sending the nice notes, even though I don't represent you anymore.
Keep doing good things.
What's that?
Keep doing good things.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Jeff, the one of the hardest things for all of us has been, and I know you've been working on it, and on page 20, it shows you've been working on it. We hear from individual alcoholism treatment providers or heroin addiction treatment providers or other substance abuse treatment providers, individual ones. We don't get a big picture as to what the need is and how much we're meeting. So leaving off those people who aren't trying to seek treatment, and I'm just talking about people who are seeking treatment, people who are willing to be treated, where are we in terms of those people seeking treatment and the capacity to provide treatment to those people? There's been a gap, we know that. Okay, where are we in terms of that gap, in terms of, I don't know, dollars, positions, waiting lists, however you can describe it?
Well, Representative Garrett, through the chair, that's exactly why we are doing the behavioral health systems assessment, is because we can't answer that question.
And through the chair, fair enough, because the question has never been answered.
Trustee Webb may have something to add.
Okay.
Chair, for the record, my name is Russ Webb. I'm a trustee of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Representative Garrett, it's an excellent question. As Jeff points out, we do not have a definitive answer. I can tell you that we do know, for those, as you indicate, seeking treatment, many of whom are seeking treatment as a result of involvement in the criminal justice system, not necessarily voluntarily seeking treatment. My wife is a district court judge in Anchorage, and she sees these cases daily. It is, there is a virtually a waiting list for everyone there are to get into treatment. Sometimes you get someone into court at the time when you are sentencing or giving someone an opportunity to take treatment as opposed to jail time. They have as high an incentive as they will have. Too many times, and frankly it happens every day, the wait to get into treatment is 6 months or so. By that time, many of them have stacked up two or three more offenses. So we're, anecdotally, we know with absolute certainty that we do not have the treatment capacity necessary to do even the minimal job of getting people who are involved in the criminal justice system, who are there in large part because of a substance abuse problem, into treatment when they need it and are ready for it.
Through the chair. Thank you. This has been, you know, folks on this committee know I ask this question every year. It's something that we all care about a lot. Will the work that you're doing give us some sort of blueprint on how to get rid of those waiting lists for those willing to or who desire treatment?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, our goal is to get much more definitive answer to this. It will be quite difficult, frankly, because in many instances, many of our providers don't keep a waiting list. So you don't know how many people are turned away over a period of time. We are trying to gather that information, and we'll do so to the best of our ability. One of the issues that the trust has worked very diligently toward is to get the best hard data that we can get to help inform our decisions about where we put money and to provide others who have momentous decisions to make now and in the future the same hard data to help guide yours.
Thank you. And then just one more. I'll just combine two into one. Jeff, on page 25. On page 25, you have your early intervention for young children program. And number one, if you can tell me what that does. More specifically, that would be good to know. And then just tell me if I misheard that you said 36% of all people incarcerated have an alcohol abuse problem.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, let me ask the second question first. 38% would qualify as trust beneficiaries because of their alcohol addiction.
How is that different than some 38% have an alcohol problem?
Well, if you look at how many people are in corrections because of an alcohol-involved crime, that's much higher. So if you are a binge drinker, well, a binge drinker would qualify as an alcoholic. But if you drank, you weren't an alcoholic, but you drank too much and committed a crime, you still end up in corrections, but you wouldn't be a trust beneficiary.
We can't treat that person anyway. So the other question.
And the early intervention for young children, what this is to try to help daycares and preschools hold on to these kids that have usually high ACE scores, adverse childhood experience scores, and are having behavior problems and are at risk of getting kicked out. Because that's a pretty common pattern, is you go into a preschool, this kid starts to act out, they just get rid of him. Well, boy, that's a double whammy, because now not only are they not in preschool or daycare, but frankly, in most cases, they're now spending more time in the environment that created the problem in the first place. So what we're trying to do is help those providers become more skilled at holding on to these kids and working with them.
Thanks. Any further questions for Representative Stoltz?
Not to be obsessed with the drug issue, Mr. Chairman, but there's debates in this building about changing the status of certain opioid, heroin, maybe the same, and other narcotics, making those misdemeanors. How does that affect your beneficiaries and the willingness to do treatment if it's a misdemeanor? Have you discussed that issue and how it's one of the interfaces of drug abusers or? And not just that, and I don't know if they'd fall in as beneficiaries. Some of them are just criminals because they're possessing them. They may not be using them. And have you talked about this as a group of trustees? And do you have an answer?
We've not discussed it specifically. I think the thing is that this will be part of the discussions involved in the new focus area, and this is the sort of discussions that led to the development of the focus area that's related to alcohol and substance abuse. If we get to a point where there's substance abuse, then it might fall within that focus area and the efforts associated with that.
Maybe Mr. Webb probably has. I saw he came up to the table. I assume that means he probably wanted to share something.
Guys, for bouncing back and forth. Again, Russ Webb, trustee of the Mental Health Trust. Representative Stoltz, I'll try to answer your one question about how does it affect someone's the trust's interests in getting treatment for someone. Frankly, the trust, if an offense is a misdemeanor or a felony, our interest, frankly, is the same in getting the right treatment to people at a time when they have a high incentive to get it and it's most likely to be successful. They would, if they are a beneficiary, they remain a beneficiary, whether they're a felon or a misdemeanor. The difference would be, and I think this is a policy question that the legislature is debating, the difference would be what type of sentence is that individual facing and what are the long-term costs?
Is there a greater incentive with a potential sentence and doing the pretrial diversions and if you have that sort of Damocles hanging over their head, or if you make it a misdemeanor, does that take away the incentive to people are less interested in religion and treatment if they if it's not going to help them get out of jail? I mean, talking to my corrections friends.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoltz, I'll give you a bit of history. I was a probation officer years ago, and I worked in the child welfare system and directed it for several years. What I've found historically is if someone is going to respond to an incentive, a negative incentive, a sentence, they will respond almost regardless of the level of that sentence. If they are not going to respond, the level of the sentence doesn't matter. So, but from our perspective, if a person is a beneficiary, they're a beneficiary.
Those are all the
drug
comments?
Questions I have today.
Well, Mr. Representative, real quick comment. I appreciate Representative Stoltz's questions about the so-called drug issues and about the marijuana initiative as well, in the sense that, you know, when that vote does come about, there's going to be a lot of Alaskans, I think, who are going to vote for it. I think there's going to be a lot who are not going to vote for it. But, you know, when you look at the ability to have some kind of public forum on it, it's pretty limited. And so I think it's fully incumbent upon us to ask, you know, any of the institutional representatives that come forward to get their input on it. And as I hear you describe, you haven't talked about it, and it's not something you can just sort of address very easily, I'm going to guess. But at the same point, I think it's very appropriate to put that question out there.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate
it. And ladies.
So that's the end of our schedule for today. Tomorrow, starting at 1:30 again, we will have, again, the governor's budget overview with the Alaska court system and the Department of Fish and Game. With that, we are adjourned.